I woke up this morning and smelled smoke inside my house. It was that bad, and it just filled up Ketchumak Bay.
A wildfire is burning 7,000 acres near Soldotna. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, preparing for the next big earthquake in Alaska.
I've heard people, researchers, probably myself included, say things like, oh, it was only magnitude 8, which is completely warped.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A 7,000-acre wildfire continues to burn on the central Kenai Peninsula. So far, no evacuations have been ordered and no property damage has been reported. The fire was called in shortly after 4 p.m. yesterday from Funny River Road near the Soldotna Airport. 40 firefighting personnel are on the scene with 6 more teams expected, including a Type 2 fire incident team, says Alaska Division of Forestry spokesperson Andy Alexandru.
And that does a couple things. It gives them the latitude through a delegation of authority on working the fire, and it frees up the forestry personnel here to concentrate on initial attack of fires.
Smoke from the fire is visible for miles along the Sterling and Kenai Spur highways. Strong northerly winds are keeping it from expanding into residential areas between Soldotna and Kasilof, but the smoke is being blown all the way down to Ketchumak Bay. The Department of Environmental Conservation has issued an air quality advisory for the entire western peninsula as far south as Homer, where KBBI's Aaron Selbig says it's affecting visibility.
I woke up this morning and smelled smoke inside my house. It was that bad, and went outside and it was thick and it just filled up Ketchumak Bay pretty quickly. It's been going on all night. Honestly, it looks like Los Angeles on a bad pollution day. All that smoke is blowing right here into Homer.
Helicopters are being used to deploy firefighters and several aerial water tankers are also in use. No fire retardants are being used due to the fire's location within the wildlife refuge. The roughly 1 mile wide by 9 mile long fire is spreading at its west and east ends. There is no estimate for when the fire might be contained. Another fire near the Alaska Native village of Tyonik is drawing a full response from state firefighters. The blaze erupted late yesterday afternoon at the village airport, which is across the Chewitna River from Tyonik. But heavy winds in the area pushed the fire across the river in several spots by evening, forcing an evacuation of the village. State Fire Information Officer Sam Harrell says crews were effective in flanking the fire on the village side overnight.
Crew on the ground in there working on a perimeter line. But the winds were driving the fire towards the village, and so they decided to burn out the fuels in between the fire and the village to slow the advance of the fire. As they did that operation, it was prudent to move people whose homes were near where this contingency line was being built.
The contingency line was successful. No structures were lost, but the fire on the other side of the river grew to 350 acres by this morning. Hand crews and helicopters dropping retardant are slowing the fire. Winds have calmed since last night. 67 firefighters are on the ground in Tyonik. About 200 national wildlife refuges have oil and gas development. Among them, the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, the only refuge in Alaska with active petroleum extraction. The agency that manages refuges, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, wants rules to regulate that activity. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaska Congressman Don Young doesn't like the idea, and he wasn't quiet about it at a congressional hearing today.
Kip Knutson, Governor Sean Parnell's appointee in Washington, told a House Natural Resources subcommittee Alaska should be exempt from any new regulation by the Fish and Wildlife Service. Knutson says it would only interfere with existing law and mineral rights.
If the goal of the rule, or these rules pondered, is to improve oil and gas activity, I'm going to predict failure. And if the goal of the rules is to slow oil and gas activity, I'm going to predict near-perfect success.
Cook Inlet Region Incorporated owns about 200,000 acres of subsurface rights in the Kenai Refuge, some leased now for exploration and production. Siri executive Ethan Schutt says the state provides all the regulation they need.
We do not need an additional layer of financial burden. We do not need an additional layer of public comment for the development of private oil and gas resources.
The issue is also a hot one for Louisiana. To make the case for federal regulation, Noah Mattson from Defenders of Wildlife showed the panel slides of rusty, leaky pipelines and oozing barrels that he said were on Louisiana refuges.
And one of my favorites, a leaking tank repaired with duct tape and a garbage bag.
On the committee, Republicans argued the Fish and Wildlife Service has no authority to impose regulations, while Democrats said such rules are long overdue. The hearing was placid until Congressman Don Young showed up. He took on Deputy Fish and Wildlife Director Steve Girton.
We're envisioning now through this proposed rulemaking, taking a lot of public input.
But let me stop there. What public? You're going to go hear from the Sierra Club? You're going to hear from Save the Earth Club? Are you going to listen and give credit to those that live there and were guaranteed by Congress the right to develop their resources?
Young suspects environmental groups are behind the agency's move for regulation, and he wanted Girton to admit it.
No, the idea about taking and not allowing people to drill on these refuges, what gives you the right to take and bring up this idea? Where did it come from?
Mr. Chairman, again, we're not talking about denying them access to their minerals.
Where did this restriction come from? Whose idea was it?
I can't point to a single individual, Mr. Chairman.
Which group?
Girton eventually named the Government Accountability Office. The GAO has twice recommended the service get a better handle on oil and gas operations in refuges. Schutt, the Siri executive, says even without the new rules, Fish and Wildlife requires bonds and special use permits. On the Kenai, at least, Schutt says the service is already regulating. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In January, Governor Sean Parnell removed Marty McGee from a board that deals with the oil producer's tax bill. Now McGee wants to take on oil tax policy again, but as a state legislator. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
McGee filed his campaign paperwork on Friday. He's running for the District 22 House seat, which covers the Sand Lake neighborhood of Anchorage. Even though the 57-year-old McGee has been a registered Republican for his adult life, he's changed his party affiliation and will be running as a Democrat. He says he doesn't feel like there's space for him to run as a centrist Republican.
The moderates are being pushed aside and not allowed to be a real material part of making policy and introducing legislation. And that's why I think I can be most effective as a Democrat in the legislature.
McGee has had his share of conflict with some of the state's most prominent Republicans. For nearly a decade, McGee served on the State Assessment Review Board. That board is responsible for deciding the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and that number is used to calculate the oil company's municipal property tax bill. For every $1 billion the pipeline is worth, the oil companies are taxed about $20 million by municipalities along the TAPS route. Last year, the board determined the pipeline was worth $12 billion, while the North Slope producers argued for $2 billion. Parnell removed McGee from the board this year because he believed the board was overvaluing the pipeline under McGee's tenure. Bernie Washington, who serves as Alaska Public Media's chief financial officer and previously worked for ConocoPhillips, was one of Parnell's picks to fill the vacancy. McGee also spent 17 years as the property tax assessor for the municipality of Anchorage. He resigned from the position in protest last year amidst disagreement with Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan after the municipality returned $1 million it collected in property taxes to NSTAR. Parnell is running for re-election and Sullivan is running for lieutenant governor. McGee says if all three of them were to end up in Juneau next year, relations probably wouldn't be friendly.
Probably not. I don't regard them as allies.
McGee says his removal from the State Assessment Review Board played into his decision to run, but it wasn't the only factor. McGee says he cares about labor issues, and he also opposes Parnell's new law capping the oil tax rate. He supports the citizens' referendum to repeal it.
I think that the state government should be working to support local governments, not as an adversary with local governments, is what I think I'm seeing going on currently.
McGee is the only Democrat to register for the Open Sand Lake House seat. Liz Vasquez, David Neese, and Sherry Jackson have all filed letters of intent for the Republican primary. Sand Lake is currently represented by Republican Mia Costello, who is vacating the seat to run for the state Senate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, subsistence hunters struggle with a shortage of ammo.
If people are ogre hunting and we have 223 ammo in and don't have enough for everybody, it would go to the people that are hunting the ogres at the time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
If you have lived in South Central Alaska for a year or more, you are almost certain to have felt an earthquake. But a damaging quake is something else again. Experts tell us a quake as powerful as the Great Alaska Earthquake of 50 years ago isn't likely anytime soon, but it doesn't take a magnitude 9 to do big damage. APRN's Steve Heimel has a story on some cautionary notes delivered by state seismologist Mike West on this morning's call-in show, Talk of Alaska.
The next big one already happened. It's just that nobody lived there. The Denali Fault quake of 2002 was magnitude 7.9, but unless you lived in Tanner Cross, Tok, or Northway, it was remote. And only afterwards did geologists see the massive landslides it caused. In a sense, seismologist Mike West says, tossing these big numbers around puts urban Alaska at risk of getting complacent.
I've heard people, researchers, probably myself included, say things like, oh, it was only magnitude 8, which is completely warped. A magnitude 7 or 8 earthquake is a massive, massive event.
But if it happens out in the Aleutian Trench, nobody even sees the damage, and the main concern is whether it would generate a tsunami. West suggests that maybe Alaskans get the idea that they've already seen it all, and he's here to tell us we haven't.
1964 is, you know, a nice benchmark. It showed us some things that can happen in an earthquake, but there are countless scenarios for other, you know, equally damaging or more so earthquakes that aren't that earthquake. So there's a small danger in treating 1964 as an example of everything that can happen.
West points to the nature of the ground we build on in Alaska and raises the question of what would happen if an earthquake of a magnitude we think we're used to were to happen directly underneath a populated area. And there is a sobering example from 3 years ago in New Zealand, where a powerful quake damaged the city of Christchurch in 2010, and then another one months later collapsed buildings already weakened.
We're talking about a magnitude 6.1 earthquake that killed 150-some people in a first-world country. And it occurred, it happened, because the earthquake was right under town. It was very shallow, and Christchurch was built on soft, wet sediments. And much of Alaska is built on soft, wet sediments.
Federal authorities are not unaware of the vulnerability of the city of Anchorage. The seismic hazard maps are being updated, and there's a set of boreholes installed by the U.S. Geological Survey in the city's downtown park strip with seismic sensors spaced at different depths to 200 feet to pick up ground waves from earthquakes and watch them travel.
This is the so-called strong motion seismic network, and it's a tremendous asset for the state and for the municipality. It's the really about the densest instrumentation of that type in the country.
That seismic network continues on up the structure of the nearby Atwood office building and at dozens of other locations around the city. And West says down the road it might be possible to install an earthquake early warning system like is being experimented with in California, though there's no active planning for it at this time. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
With the return of marine mammals and migratory birds to the Bering Straits region, subsistence hunters are still struggling to find certain kinds of ammunition. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Last month at the native store in Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, assistant manager Julian Apatiki said there are several popular calibers they can't get in stock.
The 300, 303, 222s, 243, I think.
Store manager Mary Ungut says not only are bullets used hunting seal, ugruk, and other animals hard to get, but they're more expensive.
Yeah, we've also been having a hard time getting some 22 shells. It seems that the price is increasing too.
Gamble is hardly the only place in Alaska where it's hard to get 22 caliber bullets. A recent article in the Alaska Dispatch described bare shelves and early morning lines outside Anchorage stores to snag boxes the day shipments arrive. And that demand downstate has created a choke point for supplying rural communities where ammo is an essential tool for subsistence.
If we were to get, say, 30 cases of that 22 ammo, basically what we'd have to do with the 40 stores that have ordered it is we would divide it amongst the stores. Or if there was less, we would divide it based on the need at the time.
Bill Williams manages distribution for ANICA, the Alaska Native Industries Cooperative Association. The company supplies 40 native stores and communities from the Aleutians to Kaktovik, including the one in Gamble. Part of Williams' job is anticipating inventory needs around the subsistence calendar and shipping the right bullets at the right time.
We would prioritize the subsistence needs. If people are ugruk hunting and we have 223 ammo in and don't have enough for everybody, it would go to the people that are hunting the ugruks at the time. So that's basically how we delegate it out.
Williams has had to venture beyond his Anchorage distributors to Washington State for bullets bound for village stores. Rural communities are getting hit with the tail end of a shortage created after the Sandy Hook shootings in December 2012, which sparked national ammo runs and stockpiling. But because ANICA, like many other rural retailers, places bulk orders months in advance, there was a slight buffer.
And so 2 years ago, we still had an order coming when all the stores in Anchorage ran out of ammunition. So we did have an installation because we did get a big shipment of ammo coming in. But as the summer went through and then going into the spring or the fall last year was really bad, and then this spring's been really bad, but it's starting to come back around.
The shortage is easing, if not disappearing, completely. Shotgun shells, 223s, and other common calibers for subsistence are back on shelves in Nome and Gamble, but higher prices, scarcity, rationing, and waiting periods have rural hunters wondering if this is the new normal for ammo. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
As companies look to expand oil and gas exploration in Alaska, many worry about the possibility of a spill and how wildlife, including polar bears, would be cared for. New equipment has given the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service the capability to treat polar bears on the scene, which until now hasn't been a possibility. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
A large stainless steel enclosure sits on display in the parking lot of the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. Outwardly, it's not terribly impressive. In many aspects, it looks like an oversized dog kennel, if that kennel was designed to handle a fully grown agitated polar bear. Jerry Carter is the president of Carter 2 Systems, the company that designed the holding module. He takes us inside for a quick tour.
There's two animal doors to access the transport crates, as you can see here, and then one man door that we just came through, accessible by a key, spring-loaded, front and back. So you can lock the animal in or lock people out.
The main enclosure is 12 feet wide and 12 feet long, with plenty of headroom for an adult human standing up. Flanking the holding module are two transport crates, which would hold a polar bear while in transit to the holding module from wherever it's found. Despite the enclosure's rather large size, it can all fit into a standard-sized shipping container that you would see behind a semi-truck. Carter says the holding module actually collapses all the way from its full-size 12-foot width to less than 2 feet.
When it collapses, the ceiling panels come down, floor panels come up, and then it collapses together like that.
This feature makes it easier to transport wherever it's needed. Susie Miller, a polar bear biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, says that's what makes this piece of equipment ideal.
We wanted to have something that was relatively portable that we could deploy in a field to a field situation, like if you had a spill in a remote area, that you could, all this equipment fits inside this Connex, and you could, you know, take that Connex via C-130 or cargo aircraft or barge, deploy it to a field site, and treat bears more rapidly, if you know, in the field.
The enclosure provides a space to clean oil from the bears and for veterinarians to observe and treat them if necessary. Miller says the holding module will likely just house one bear, or possibly a family of bears, which would include a mother and small cubs. But there are other situations where multiple bears could share the same space.
It does also allow us to treat adult males, or another scenario might involve sibling bears, second-year cubs, or bears that are released from their mother. They're no longer dependent on their mother, but they're still hanging around together. We call them sub-adults. You could potentially put two sub-adults together, but you wouldn't put strange bears that weren't related, non-related bears together.
Once it's broken down and packed into the Connex, it will be shipped up to Dead Horse on the North Slope, where it will be based out of. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Joe Robidoux has been found not guilty on all counts. A Sitka jury of 7 women and 5 men delivered its verdict in favor of a former school administrator accused of sexual assault last evening. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The one-time Blatchley Middle School principal sobbed quietly as Magistrate Leonard Devaney, tagging in for David George on the Superior Court bench, read each verdict form in order.
State of Alaska versus Joseph Robidoux, verdict form number 1. Count 1, sexual assault in the second degree, KL, during May 2012. We, the jury, find the defendant, Joseph Robidoux, not guilty of sexual assault in the second degree.
And so it went for 4 additional counts of sexual assault, 3 counts of indecent exposure, and 1 count of assault in the 4th degree. The state had pressed charges on behalf of 3 separate witnesses, all current or former teachers at Blatchley Middle School. Robidoux had been facing 5 to 10 years prison time had he been convicted. Magistrate Devaney informed him that with the not guilty verdicts, he was free to go. Both Robidoux's attorney, Julie Willoughby, and Assistant District Attorney Gene Seaton, who prosecuted the case, declined comment. Several jurors also declined to speak about the case at this time. After a week-long trial and 12 hours of deliberation over 2 days, as she put on her raincoat to head out into a rainy Sitka evening, one juror simply looked at reporters and said, "Not today." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Anchorage School Board voted to increase the 2014-15 school budget by $26.5 million last night. With the additional money, the district will be able to hire back 86 teachers they thought they would lose, but not all of them. And there are more cuts to come in the next few years. KSKA's Ann Hillman reports.
Monday night's discussion of next year's school budget focused on the best ways to use the limited funds to help all of the students. School board member Pat Higgins said they tried hard to limit the impacts of the budget shortfalls and balance the needs of different groups.
We try to do everything possible using the extra funds we've got to lessen the impact so the kids can be successful and the staff would have the resources. We weren't able to put everything back, but I think at the end of the day, people would say we tried to be fiscally responsible and we put kids first.
Higgins said the education funding cuts could get even bigger in the future and lead to much larger class sizes and potentially fewer schools.
We have got to really educate the public and educate the legislature what it means not to fund public education.
School board members debated a number of topics, including the value of planning periods for middle school teachers. Those periods are designed to give teachers a chance to work together, both to plan lessons and to focus on how to help struggling students. Board member Natasha von Imhoff argued it may not be the best way to use money.
When you have limited resources, it comes down to choice. Where is the best place to invest your limited resources that will positively impact the greatest number of students? Is the best investment the middle school team planning time, or is it actually implementing the various student interventions? Can you have one without the other?
The board ultimately voted that teachers for core subjects like English, math, and social studies need time to work together as a team, but elective teachers do not. Other conversations revolved around the importance of summer school. Is it worth redirecting $1 million from other programs or from the fund balance to rebuild the district's summer school program? Board member Tammy Agosti-Gisler said she fully supports summer school, but it comes down to a larger issue: using the money to employ teachers and support staff in the upcoming years.
I hate to keep beating the same horse, but I want to remind you that we have 157 positions to eliminate next year. $1 million is 10 of those.
Projected budgets for the next 3 years, 2015 to 2018, require cutting 555 more positions. The board also amended the budget to provide charter schools with an additional $1.27 million from the fund balance. The money was granted in response to community members who said the district's 7 charter schools need it to help pay for their facilities. Other funds will go toward the 3-year-long pilot projects like early literacy programs, pre-K classes, and upgrading classroom technology. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.